Okay, I'm ready. So it's interesting. You see all the people shivering in the cold here. I'm just chilling myself. All right, so I very creatively titled this after the title of the conference, Where Are MOOCs Going? What is the Future of Distance Learning? And for those listening on audio, it's September 25, 2015, or as we say these days, 2015, and we're on the beautiful island of Capri at Federica University's Future of MOOCs Conference. So here's where I want to begin. Kind of a reaction to some of the discussion that's taken place thus far. Most of what's been done in MOOCs to date over the last 7 years has, in my mind, completely missed the point of MOOCs in the first place, particularly that George Siemens and I put together. Not simply missing the meaning of the word open, although they did miss the meaning of the word open. And as I've commented several times over the last couple of days, it's been widely interpreted now to mean the word closed, or at the very least, money-making and sustainable. And now it's MOOCs are like, one of our misbehaved children that don't know how to behave in polite society. But more to the point, people have forgotten what the meaning of the word massive is, particularly when combined with the word courses. It doesn't just mean broadcasting. It doesn't just mean creating videos and sending them to the world. That was done with television. And if that was all that we were creating when we were creating MOOCs, we were really not very creative at all. And I even want to raise as a bit of subtext, because it's come up in the discussion so far, what does it mean to talk about universal access to learning and education? And as a bit of a spoiler, it doesn't mean access to content. Why does it do this? So our revolution, or innovation, I guess maybe a bit more accurately, was twofold. First of all, when we built our original MOOCs, way before Coursera, we built a distributed platform, and it was the distributed nature of our MOOCs that enabled it to scale. If we had just simply done, a Moodle thing like everybody else was doing at the time, then we would have been able to support 24 or maybe 100 students like everybody else at the time. We built a distributed platform so that when 2,000 people came to our course, which was about 19,800 or 1,980 more people than we expected, our system didn't collapse. And secondly, our courses were not based on pumping out a bunch of content to people. When George and I started the original MOOC, what we wanted to say is we wanted to demonstrate what we meant by connectivism by engaging in connectivism. And we would engage in it as instructors, and participants would engage in it as students. And what that meant is not everybody getting the same content and blasting out videos to people, but everybody getting something personal, something individual. The idea was to create a multitude of different perspectives. And through the difference of perspectives, that's where you would get meaningful interaction. And for the life of me, I don't know how you get meaningful interaction if everybody's seeing the same thing. It just doesn't make much sense to me. So the technological foundation of what we built was around an application that I wrote called Grasshopper. And Grasshopper really is a very simple piece of technology. It aggregates content from either the user or from any of a number of different content feeds. We had participants in the course create their own content in their own place at their own time, and we would bring it into the course. They could also recommend content. So we didn't create a bunch of content We aggregated open content, freely available content from all around the web. And it's one of the things that the MOOC movement, quote unquote, tends to forget. There's a ton of free and open content all over the web. We don't need to build new content anymore. I know there's a fly there. I'm just waving, but there's a fly there. And so, and yeah, the next part would be to organize the data, do a little bit of entity extraction on it, assemble it in easy-to-digest chunks that different people could access in different ways, a bunch of suggestions, if you will, as opposed to course content, and then send them out in different formats like email newsletters, web pages, RSS, etc. And interestingly and importantly, you could take one of our MOOCs without ever engaging with our platform, and people did. And it would have been as completely good an experience as being on the platform. And I think that's a really important aspect of an open course. The design of our MOOCs was based, at least in part, on some of the discussions of personal learning environments that had been taking place. You might remember, or maybe not, because most MOOC people came into the field, let's just say recently. There was a series of conferences around the idea of personal learning environments in 2006. This diagram from Scott Wilson was done in 2006, I believe. The one by Tim Hand is a little bit later. But it's still the idea of creating individual user perspectives and engagements. Individual user perspectives and engagements with an authentic environment by creating mechanisms for connecting to or interacting with that environment. Today's MOOCs, insofar as they provide a personal experience at all, which most of them don't, provide a personal experience by means of quote-unquote personalizing learning. And that's a lot of the talk recently has been about personalized education, which at best is adaptive learning, and people are talking about adaptive learning frameworks and things like that, or maybe the dynamic formation of small groups as though that personalizes learning. But you want to compare the difference, as the slide says, between personalized and personal. Personalized is something that somebody does for you. Personal is something that you do for yourself. The focus on personalized is on the institution, institutional needs, and frankly, so far, that's all I've heard in this room. Well, it's good for the institution. Will the institution survive? How will the institution adapt? Oh, my. My focus is on the person, not the student, because that's just an artifact of the institution. Most people in the world are not students, but those are people who need learning and education, particularly those who can't afford it. Let me draw this out a bit. There are, as in everything in life, two approaches. If I was a Taoist, I'd say there are three approaches. Never mind. So this is a caricature, obviously. But it's a good caricature because it allows me to draw some really good distinctions. I don't have a beautiful kaleidoscope picture. And I am not theorizing education. This is not a theory. It's not a model. It's just, never mind. On the one hand, you can begin with content and move to practice. On the other hand, you can begin with practice and move to content. Inside schools, almost universally, we begin with content and maybe move to practice. The rest of the world does it the other way around, from practice to content. So let's look at these two different states a bit more deeply. The content focus is based on, and I'm even going to channel Steve Krause here a bit, the Platonic ideal of the ideal state. It's based on, you know, some kind of concept of knowledge, if you will. The practice-based approach is based on an outcome, a desired state, trying to get something done. That's often the difference between formal and informal education, right? Formal education, a bunch of knowledge just in case you need it. Informal education is focused on the task or whatever you're trying to do in the moment. In the content to practice base, you get a bunch of content, then you try to practice in the very imperfect method of, say, tests or assignments, and somebody tests you and decides whether or not you are worthy to continue. On the other hand, the practice, the content approach, you do something, you get an outcome, and then there's somebody there in an educational environment where a person tries to help you. You see the difference between the judging and the helping function. The judging function, institutions really value this, and indeed, if it were not for the judging function, one would question whether the institution would have, as they say, a market advantage at all. So what happens in the content-based approach, you get tested. Now if we're doing advanced learning, like adaptive learning, we'll identify a gap and we'll apply a correction. We'll go back to content again and repeat until finished. The practice, on the other hand, is a mechanism of continuous improvement. You try something, and that creates an opportunity rather than a requirement to improve, and so you can go through another iteration. For those of you who are involved in software design, this is waterfall, that is agile. For those of you not involved in software design, that meant nothing. The two models, library and environment. People have been talking about books, right? And the course as a book. Well, that's right into the content model, right? The environment model is the model that I'm up to. The place where you do things, the place where you practice, the place where you try stuff out and see where the opportunities lead you. The place where you do whatever it is that you want to get done, as opposed to what other people want you to do. Very important. This is personalized, and most of the educating will be done for you. I was talking to somebody yesterday, you know who you are, who was talking about, oh yeah, our courses are special because we have this learning design, and it's our unique learning design that carries people through the content. You're doing almost all of the work for the learner. The learner is kind of, I've been through courses like that. Maybe not your courses, but I've been through courses like that. You're so passive, and you're waiting for it to be over. Personal, you do for yourself. Personal, you're trying to do something, you do for yourself. You decide what you want to achieve for yourself. It's like Rita was saying just before the break. People who go to MOOCs for a wide variety of different reasons. When we were designing our MOOCs, originally, we realized from the start that we would have people who were complete novices to people who had doctorates in education, and as it turned out, doctorates and a whole bunch of other things. We knew that some people were curious, some people wanted to learn more, some people wanted to simply attack us and call us techno-communists. All of that was fine, even the techno-communists. In the world of MOOCs, the content side is the ex-MOOC, the standardized, everybody gets the same content. I will give you videos, etc. It's Coursera, it's edX, it's FutureLearn, it's the rest of them. It's funny because it dies on the screen before it dies here. There we go, we're all back. So in the middle, kind of, because it's sort of kind of in the middle, is the engagement model. Jim Groom's DS-106 is a classic example of that. But even Jim Groom's DS-106 is kind of tied to the content. It's based in a university. He has a curriculum he's going through. I've seen a number of iterations of this course. They're different every time, but he's covering the same material. On the far side is the network-based approach. That was how we designed our original MOOCs. The original MOOCs before Coursera and the rest of them looked like networks, not books. And that's what made them scale. And that's what made them massive. And that's what made them personal. When we created our MOOCs, a lot of people asked us, well, how do you make a MOOC? Unfortunately, the people at Coursera and the rest of them didn't ask us, but that's okay. And we told them, it's like creating a network. Don't set up centralized points. Don't set up bottlenecks or single points of failure, because that's where it will fail. And concentrate, instead of creating content, concentrate on creation of links. Creation of links between people and other people. Creation of links between people and instructors where necessary. Creation of links between people and content. And not just you creating links for people, but create an environment where people can create links for each other to find relevant material in whatever the field of study is and to share it with each other. That leads me, anyways, to my own work and our team's own work in what we believe is the direction of MOOCs in the future, which we call Learning and Performance Support Systems. It's interesting, the Canadian Society for Training and Development today announced that they're changing their name to the Institute for Performance and Learning. Come on, there we go. It's coming. Oh, we've got to do that again. Okay. Be like that. It's funny because I was making fun of somebody earlier for using a Macintosh. And I was saying, my computer just works. So the Learning and Performance Support System is designed with the same philosophy and outlook as our original MOOCs, where the PLR, that's the personal learning record, that's the learner at the center, and then the other support services around them, and we've divided them broadly into four categories: resource repository network, personal learning assistant, personal cloud, and automated competency detection and recognition, or development and recognition. But key is that the LPSS is built around an individual personal learning record. I'll talk a little bit more about that, but for now, what we're doing is we're creating a graph-based database that records all of the person's interactions and activities, not just with the learning management system, because that would be silly, but with all of the different parts of the distributed environment in which they learn and in which they engage, both in a course, if they're taking a course, but also in their home and their work environment. Now, obviously, if we put this on our own platform and started data mining this, that would be a gross invasion of privacy and probably illegal. So equally important to the value proposition of LPSS is that the personal graph is personal and private and not shared and not mined without the user's explicit permission. So the point here is to help the person learn rather than turn the person into a product that will be monetized. The rest of LPSS is built around the personal learning record. This is the 1,000-word version of that. Basically, stuff goes in, stuff goes out. Sometimes I save that stuff in my personal library. That personal library is on the cloud. It can be anywhere, including in my own networks, sitting in my living room. I do learning activities with my stuff. I might consume content. I might play with toys. I might make stuff. If I make stuff, I can share my stuff with other people. This is people do stuff, people learn. And then the analytics helps me. The analytics is the brains of the system. It interprets stuff. It finds new stuff in stuff. For example, it might do a sentiment analysis on a piece of content and tell me that the writer was hostile. It then allows me to screen out all the hostile posts. That's really nice. Here's a more detailed look at part of the system. This is the resource repository network. Look at the types of content that we're looking at here. This is why a platform-based or single-platform-based MOOC system, or LMS, is inadequate to the tasks that we're up to. We're getting email, RSS, Open Archives Initiative, but also Facebook and Twitter, SharePoint, Monster, because people are interested in employment, government repositories, including there's a system in Canada for government contracts and also for employment opportunities. LMSs like Desire to Learn and Coursera, edX, etc. Now, there may be some outliers here who don't want to allow people to access their learning materials. Some of them even call themselves open, which is a bit of a joke, but I'm not worried about them. The people who lock themselves out are locking themselves out of a learning ecosystem. It gets processed, parsed, scraped, analyzed, sliced, diced, flaked, and formed, do whatever, and according to personal needs and personal attributes. If, for example, you speak Spanish, it translates it into Spanish. If, for example, I can go on with examples, but you get the idea. And what we're trying to do, what we are doing, is we take this, those in, on the right are the entities or the nodes in a graph. The idea is the system creates a graph representation of all the content, all the interactions, all the activities that you've undertaken. That graph can learn all about you, and that graph helps you learn. That graph is kind of like another brain working right along with your brain, working together. The personal learning record, it's a little bit more detail. It doesn't go into great detail. There's three major categories of data that we want to capture and make use of. First of all, the actual activities. There's a specification out there called XAPI or Experience API. We're using this. We support this. We do support external learning record stores, but we also capture learning activity data and store it in the personal graph. Also, things that are created, portfolios, artifacts, evidence, emails, videos, whatever. Anything that a person creates forms a part of their personal learning record. And of course, they go on to become learning resources for other people. That's a really important part of the ecosystem because it creates an ecosystem. We don't need to depend on institutions and publishers to create all of our learning content when we can easily create our own learning content in the process of learning. There's a whole discussion about how to make sure the best content comes to the top, but that's a subject of graph-based content analysis. Finally, badges, certificates, credentials, competencies. There's a whole bunch of ways of stating the things that you've learned. And we capture that. We analyze a person's performance based on all of the other things and based on their interaction in the network, not just the MOOC, not just the LMS, but the entire ecosystem. So we can detect if a person has acquired a competency by instances of that competency being applied in their learning or in their work environment. And it takes us to the question of what is learning. Steve Krause, right before us, talked about Paulo Freire's banking model, and that model has been alluded to a bunch of times. You know, people have to get the content, remember the content, right? So it's a model of learning where you acquire stuff. Our perspective on learning is that it is engagement and experience in, like I put, professional networks. I probably should have said authentic networks, or just networks generally. It doesn't really matter whether they're professional or authentic, but it helps. But the idea is by working and doing in these networks, we grow our knowledge and capacities. We do not acquire knowledge. We do not transfer knowledge. As any good constructivist knows, you create it anew each time. The problem with any good constructivist is they don't exactly always know how that happens, but that's what happens. And we're back. Oh, my goodness.
Again.
I'm sorry. And I was on such a roll, too. I'm almost done, but we go all the way. Oh, wait. Oh, this is going to work. Ta-da! We didn't have to go through all the slides. See, practice in an authentic environment creates a state. You grow the ability, and now your experience and new knowledge is demonstrated in performance. That was an object lesson. The evaluation of learning, there was a discussion a little bit earlier about how inadequate tests are. And educators, you are educators and researchers. You know your testing instruments are inadequate. Why do you keep using them? Right? You know your research based on test outcomes is inadequate. Why do you keep doing it? You're like the guy that's just down the street from me. I saw him the other day. He's out with his lawnmower going up and down his driveway. And I asked him, why are you doing that? Well, it's easier, he said. Okay. Obviously, in international days. Learning is not the possession of a collection of facts which are to be repeated. It's a state of mind, a full state of mind. We could talk for ages on that. To be a physicist isn't to know a bunch of facts about physics. It's to act like a physicist. Think like a physicist. Talk like a physicist. Be able to answer the problems in the back of the chapter, as Thomas Kuhn said. To think some problems are important and other problems are not important. To think some evidence counts as evidence and other things do not count as evidence. That's what it is to be a physicist. When we test people for their knowledge of formulas, we're missing 90% of what it is. Sorry. Learning is, in practice, recognition of the capacity by a community of experts. That's why when we take doctors in to practice doctoring, we don't have them take a test and then send them into the neuroscience lab. We have an experienced doctor watch them perform operations. And it's not a test so much as the experienced doctor recognizes from the full scope of performance what that is. But you can't do that in a single environment. You can't do that in a MOOC. You have to do that in a distributed system which allows people to work in these environments, which was what we created when we created the first MOOC. We've been building on it since then. These are medical simulations. I love the expression on that guy's face. Yeah, somebody has opened my abdomen and I feel a little cold. Flight simulators. I would not trust a pilot who did not put in hundreds of hours in a flight simulator. Because a lot of stuff that happens in airplanes happens only once, right? And you want them to have practiced it. Again, how are you going to put this in Coursera? Mobile Interactive Trainers technology that we actually have in NRC, it's to teach police and military engagement. Now, on the one hand, it's, you know, it's a gun, you shoot with it, it's practice, right? But on the other hand, it's engagement, so you learn how to work in teams, you learn how to detect what's important, what's not important, all the things surrounding the proper use of security and coordination in a threat environment, not just, you know, do you shoot, do you not shoot, do you shoot straight. This is more NRC technology, which is also connected to LPSS because it's a distributed system. It's a neural touch simulator. You use real neural instruments, practice on a fake brain. That's a fake brain. In case you were squeamish, it's not real. But it feels real. They even have the texture right, right? And you practice with it. I practice burning tumors, and I burned mostly tumors. But that person no longer knows what the capital of France is. Sorry, I'm just kidding. but again, you do your work in this. It gets sent back into your personal learning record. That, in turn, impacts the recommendations of resources that are out there. If you're burning tumors, fine, no problem. If you can't tell the difference between tumors and healthy brain tissue, it's going to send you resources that say, this is tumor, this is brain tissue. Burn this, don't burn that. I'm exaggerating, of course, but you get the idea. And, you know, because you're in this environment, you do your neural surgery, you get your experience back, you share your experience with your friends. You can share video of you doing brain surgery with your mother if you want it. Sometimes that's important. Sometimes it's not. So you have this environment, this distributed environment, where people can coalesce or cluster around topics of interest. You don't have to preform people into groups. That's doing it for them, right? The rest of the world mostly forms groups on their own. Sim welding, that's another part of our project. This guy here is just a stock photo. But this guy on the right is one of our actual researchers doing the same task as the one pictured, but again, in the it's the NeuroTouch simulator, but that's not a brain anymore, that's a piece of metal. So overall, see, the idea here is you're working in actual, real environments. These environments can be anywhere. Sometimes they're on computers. Sometimes they're, you know, people sitting in a room talking. That's good. That's useful. And it did it again. That's okay. I was almost done. But sometimes it's working with actual tools in actual places doing actual things. And in fact, for those of us who are not in our educational institutions, that's what most of life is like, where we really, really are in genuine environments. And all the way to here. Are we up yet? No, of course not.
Pressing the button.
You pressing the button? Yeah. Oh my goodness. Try it again.
Ta-da.
That's really unfortunate because I did have one more good slide and it's just being very annoying.
Do you want to move your presentation on the other computer?
No, it's going to take too long. I don't know why it's just basically just shut down now. So, I'll do one more try. One more try, and then I'm going to give up. Ah, for goodness sakes. No. It's on there. There we go. I don't know why it was just frozen like that. It's just... La di da di da di da. Are we good? Yeah, we're good. Okay. Sorry about that. I sometimes really, really, really hate technology. So what we're doing is we're taking MOOCs to the logical conclusion, right? The logical conclusion here is not nicer content or actors in videos or more people or artificially formed groups. Then the logical conclusion is to make the web more distributed and provide more capacity and more interconnection for the individual personal learning space accessing the learning materials and the learning community. One more comment about data, because there have been a bunch of MOOC research initiatives, and you guys are doing a bunch of MOOC research. There are two types of research data, two types of big data. There's the type that's being done now, for example, the orange box across edX, or it could be Coursera or whatever, which may be covering millions of people, but it's really, really shallow, isn't it? Because it's describing the interface only with a particular system. It tells us about the system. It doesn't tell us anything about the people in the system, except in the aggregate. If you tried to do surgery that way, you would kill most of your patients, right? A person walks in, well, 80% of people with these symptoms need to have their liver removed. Let's remove the liver. I mean, that would be irresponsible. I am much, much more interested in deep data. Deep data talks about one person or maybe a small group of people in a hybrid case across a wide variety of platforms. This is actually relevant research. This is research about people and how people learn, as opposed to research about platforms and how platforms do whatever it is that they do, whether it's relevant or not. One final note, so we're expanding the LPSS project. Basically, the way we will work with MOOCs and other providers is that we will connect with them. Typically, we will partner with a university, a government agency, or whatever. We will contribute part of our investment. We expect them to contribute part of their investment, and, of course, we seek additional funding through foundations and corporate partners. What we are doing is connecting LPSS to individual applications, so it's kind of like, you know, the MOOC aggregator stuff, except it's an individual MOOC aggregator, one for each person, which is really how it should be. And that's my presentation, and I thank you. Sorry about the time.
Is there a difference between education and learning?
Yes.
Say that again?
Education is learning, not teaching.
That's short. I like it.
Right. Yes. Okay. Yeah. I agree with that. I mean, I don't know if you want to...
I would say learning is an individual process, and education, and there are more players in there, and politicians, institutions, and there are purposes there. Like I mentioned Paulo Freire.
Sure.
You know, he wanted people to learn, but in an educational way, so the society would change as well. So, and I would say that's more to do with education than with learning. So there's a purpose, there's control by somebody who has an ideology or whatever you want to call it.
We can say that we can live without education, but we can't live without learning. Mm.
Yes, that's...
I often use, given the video example, Fagan from Oliver Twist. He's a very effective teacher for the students who are very effective learners when they need educated. So it's a graduate teacher in the final model of business. The philosophy there, of course, you could argue that Fagan is actually the best university, the most
I have a question for Stephen. I mean, since that, of course, you've been, you say, a forefront of this revolution when we started with the good movie, and what you told us yesterday is that it took a different course in a way, and it was not the course that you had envisaged. Which is important in a way. That's usually what political scientists, that should be our business. We always try and explain why things took a different course. And then we have philosophers who tell us how it should be. And then we come up a little bit later and we say, what went wrong with Iraq? You know, that's the big real question. At the time, everyone thought they knew what. And now, because you get, you know, you have both sides, you have your vision of one side, and you're pretty well aware by having been in this business, it's a very obviously active role of how things develop. So try and leave state of those aside for just a moment. I mean, try to be not the philosopher, but the politician, the economist. I mean, I like very much the entry point of just the intervention of making this white paradigm. Because I still think that that's the level of abstraction which that we have not yet defined what is really happening. I mean, you know, what learning, technologies, forces, whatever. But what's your estimate? I mean, what's your vision? What are the driving, not what you think should be the driving? Because that is clear. I mean, I can see your vision in a way. Do you still believe that you may take this different route, let's say, that everything becomes so much more bottom-up dream, but use a very, you know, stupid, but in a way, because that was the spirit of what the way you were, in a way, envisaging a system where connectivity would definitely be, you know, pushing and developing whatever, or what could be the route that 2 years, 5 years from now will. It is clear that what we see now is only the beginning on the other side. Let me give a very simple, short example, which comes more from within my own, you know, brain size. I've been working on e-politics, e-democracy for 20 years.
Sure.
And we have seen all of this, you know, sort of our laboratories. I mean, how things should go, what should happen. And then for 20 years, nothing really happened. I mean, you had experiments, cities, which you say would be really great, Athenian, Polish, whatever, Bush. I mean, nothing which really made a difference in the real point. Then two things happened, which has become extremely important. One, Obama, and Obama didn't use the net to change the politics. He has made his own revolution through television, but he used the net to raise money. And if he didn't have the 3 million people on MoveOn, he would not have created. And then there was also participation, there was also a new way, there was a little bit in the old spirit, you see. But it was important that he used the net to create a financial power to beat the Republic. That was still pretty traditional, but it was innovative in the sense it was using the net, not caring so much about the revolution. And then another thing happened later, which has been extremely innovative, and it was real. You know, the guy has made a 25% party out of nowhere, and everything is on the net, and it's the most lenient cyber credit organization you can ever imagine. So he has this incredible participation from the bottom, but everyone always speaks through his own website. Could you ever thought that could be possible, you know, the whole utopia or the policy or whatever? And then he comes with a very smart, just him, he's a comedian, he's a fantastic, you know, speaker, again, great TV man, but he has this great associate, and he's an intimate guru. So he's a guy who's very much to the profession. So you see, again, this was not in cards. Nobody thought you have this bottom, and then someone comes there, boom! I mean, Italy is completely messed up. This guy in less than 6 months came up with a 25% party, and he's still there. I mean, after 3 years, good. What is your mission? I mean, how do you see these two competing forces coming together in the next 5? So we know better how to position the pentagram, I mean, and the five squares.
So, let's understand right off the bat that we have two competing forces. That's crystal clear. And if my comments of yesterday didn't make that crystal clear, let me make that crystal clear. and I've described these in the past under the heading of groups and networks. And it's really bad terminology, and I apologize for it. Maybe I should have called them collectives and connectives. But the one is based on mass, and the other is based on organization, right? So the collectives or the groups are based on mass, and the connectives or the networks are based on organization. Now, of course, they're both types of networks, so we'll leave that terminological problem aside. So the collectives is the order of the past. As I say, based on mass, it's based on accumulation. And interestingly, the examples that you gave were both examples based on accumulation, right? Obama's accumulation of money, and the Italian politicians' accumulation of support. So I take the examples, but I see those as examples still out the old system. Power does not give up power lightly or easily. And that's what happened with MOOCs, right? MOOCs were an attempt to create something based on organization. And became subverted almost immediately as a tool to create organization based on mass and thereby to preserve power structures based on mass. And again, this is power structures based on massive amounts of money or massive amounts of people or whatever. And we talked about that in some detail. So, and I think even to this point, a lot of the instances of what people are calling revolutionary in the network world, I'm thinking of things like Uber and Facebook and things like that, are still phenomena based on math. We truly are at the very beginning of this. And we're not seeing manifest, because it's a lot more difficult, a lot of the changes that are based on organization. So, and right now, really, the only way to see them is to be connected to the internet 24/7, living, breathing on it, as basically I've been doing, at the expense of career, a salary, whatever, because I'm totally absorbed in this, and sometimes it shows. But it's there. And I think as time progresses, we will see, and this is not Stephen thinking what it should be, but this is Stephen thinking what it's going to be like. And we are going to see
as the strength of networks connections increase, and they will increase, they are increasing, the strength of individual empowerment increases, and this forms a counterforce against the organizations based on mass, power, and control. And we are seeing this. For me, the significant event of the last few years is not Obama, and it's not anything to do with the existing political system. It's Occupy. Occupy was an incredibly important thing that happened. People at the end of it said, you know, they criticized it. Oh, well, they don't stand for anything. There's no organizing force. There's no leadership. And well, yeah, exactly. And a lot of people realized that people could work together without having a single voice, single leadership, single objective, single ideal, but that capacity in itself was, if you will, the revolution. That's happening. As long as nothing is inevitable, zero things are inevitable, but so long as the capacity to interact and form networks continues to increase, this social movement will continue. And indeed, we see the entrenched positions of power trying to crack down on that and trying to make it harder for people to communicate. So you see Facebook centralizing. You see Google centralizing. You see Apple centralizing, trying to form barriers that block people from communicating. But I'm thinking that as long as, you know, and in a sense, the electronic genie is out of the bottle. We have learned as individuals in a society that we can communicate directly at a distance electronically. It's going to be very hard to take that away.
Thank you very much. And more questions?
In your talk, I took from your talk the idea that we hang on to the idea of human and what we do in educating. I think for me, part of the issue there is that we don't really know where that human lies. You know, so for example, you were talking about serendipity, you know, and the way in which things surface on the internet, we know it's not linked back to human agency, and so often about the operation of algorithms and the way that code kind of surfaces particular items in social media. I mean, Twitter is one example of that. Twitter is a kind of force of human agency. It's heavily mediated by algorithms and code. And that's kind of structured into it. So I guess my point, or my question really would be, how do we as educators who are committed to an idea of the human, as I think you are, work with that and raise that as a critical issue rather than taking the human as a given, the human agency as a given within highly mediated environment?
Well, as I start, it will be one of the main issues to grapple with. You know, Twitter is media, and it's becoming more and more structured and arranged through algorithms. But what is still possible there is to form groups easily, if that's what you want, to arrange your information through people that you think have similar ideas or similar background or totally different ideas, different background. Twitter is only an idea, is only one way of doing that. These environments and social networks become more and more, closed, as Stephen says, or at least I'm talking, the research I did was in 2010, so Twitter was only really starting then, but my point is that it's important somehow to keep the human in the whole organization. And if you move out of a group-based organization, it can be through blogs and commenting on blogs, or there are very interesting conversations there. The only thing you have to find out then is how to well, how to pull the information to you, how to move into this stream of human interaction. So, well, the way I do it is through RSS and Twitter. Those are, for me, at the moment, the best ways of doing that, plus a number of people that I filter information through.
So it's not, well, actually, in motivation theory, one example say, education can only demotivate people. So motivation is already there, and education is providing guidance, the mass, and it only demotivates. And in both of you, is that you're not advocating the importance of the informal learning you find outside the formal education?
Yeah.
So that you need guidelines, recognition, stimulants on that informal way of learning.
Why do you need that? Let's analyze that for a second. Right? You need that because the current social order is such that either you work or you starve. And the only way to get work is to get credentials. So the social order is you get credentials or you starve. And that social order is created by the fact that certain segments of society have amassed all of the resources, all of the wealth for themselves, and they won't share. And that's how they force people to work or starve. Right? Now, we can play utopian for a second and say, well, if we had a completely networked society, that wouldn't be the case. That's probably not true. But what I want to point to is the whole mechanism of control that requires certification is not nearly as stable a proposition as you might think. In fact, I would argue it's incredibly unstable. It's an edifice that is on the verge of collapse, frankly. I wrote The Future of Online Learning in 1998. In a similar time span to the future now, degrees and certificates will be much less valuable than they are now. An actual demonstration of capacity and proven practice in a network environment will be much more important. It's the removal of an important form of power and control. So, the existence of formal learning as a structure is an imposition of the will of those in power to create an agenda for learning. As that power wanes, that agenda wanes.
Yeah, I don't quite agree with that.
Well, I didn't think you would.
You know each other quite well in that respect. Because, and I started telling, I'm working for a for-profit. There was a time that the university was what it started out to be. Something that made society what it is, that cultivated culture, that made us what we are. If you look in what the university is becoming, not to me, it's a professional development system. And, we can argue about that and what the purpose of a university should be. Because I thought it was, to me, the university used to be a force for good, and without that, well, we become the Googles and the Ubers of the world.
You sound like you're agreeing with me.
But you see that, Stephen, this is I think this is an important point of debating. Because I belong to the public, I still think the university should be what they were. And I happily live in a country where this statement is in a way in the constitution, and I would say that I would think that that's the same case for France. I mean, but it is true that, of course, we can see that the market is also operating into different, directions. And of course, there's a huge debate here, talking about what you're saying about credits. You know, there is a debate in this country whether we should at last get rid of this formal recognition of the degree certificate. And of course, most people on the left
seeing, the moment we get rid of this, the private forces, I mean, which means private universities, and the whole, corporate environment, which can really put money into this whole thing, it's going to take over. So it's not that simple in the sense that the moment we take this credit system off, it becomes important to know when, what's the time frame that we could probably move from the bottom before a different top takes over. Let me be the political scientist, because it's a matter of it's a complex battleground, and we can see this on a day by day. I mean, the only reason why we have gained a little bit of space within my university and the university system in Italy, as far as this whole, MOOC project and even the possibility of getting together, is because there are private universities which are now stealing the grad, and they are doing it in a rather, not universalistic way. Mm-hmm. So, it is a complex environment with respect to this, you see. And in fact, you see, someone like Rita, she moved from, and I think that most of her values belong to the kind of universe you're envisioning, but at the same time, she says,
When I left Swansea University, they had just closed the philosophy department, so, to me, that was the end of it,
So, what was it that universities used to be? So we need to be careful here. Before, I don't know, the 1960s, the 1970s, there really wasn't any concept of mass university education. And they were basically the preserve of the privileged. When we go back to what universities were, there's a danger that we go back to that. A lot of people are very nostalgic for those days, but those days only existed for a small minority of the people. The other thing is, including all of us, and I'm very aware of that. I mean, I'm someone who got into the university by the skin of my teeth, literally. I got into the University of Calgary when it was very open, and I got in under special considerations because of my age. They called me a non-matriculated adult. 2 years before or 2 years after, I would not have entered university, and I would have had a hopefully productive and rewarding career as a restaurateur, or maybe managing a McDonald's. So I'm really aware of that knife edge, really keenly aware of that knife edge. And I think that matters. I think universities historically have been mechanisms to preserve and extend power. And we thought, and by we I mean people on the left, thought that by extending access to universities to everyone, we would be extending power to everyone. But I think that there was a misunderstanding on all parts about just what it was that universities did in order to extend power. And it's exactly what Rita pointed out. It's communication, sharing, socialization, the creation of networks of influence. People go to Yale not because they're great teachers and great learning. They go to Yale because they'll meet other people who go to Yale. Right, and it's funny now because now they trade on that and make money off of it by offering Yale online learning. But of course, it's not Yale because the Yale education is meeting other people. So, what is it when we say we need to preserve the university structure? I love the university structure. It made me what I am, instead of an average restaurateur in a minor city in Canada. Cannot underestimate the value of that. But simply pumping out more content at people and giving them degrees so that they qualify for jobs isn't it. But neither is going back to the old system.
going back to the old system, simply takes us back to the preserved looking out for them, or the elite looking out for themselves. So we have to invent something new.
What role do you see the state of play in education with the reproduction of Indigenous problems? Particularly for Indigenous people, Canada is a good example.
So, do you want to know what it does do or what it should do? Okay. Because what it does do is it creates a narrative which is often highly politicized. And makes that narrative the backstory of what we call a nation or a culture. We've seen a lot of revisionism of that story in Canada over the last 8 years. And so, again, we become pretty aware of that. You know, let's take Aboriginal culture, which is important and should be shared, should be preserved, but the way to do that is not to impose Aboriginal culture on people. That would be absurd. The way to do that is to empower individuals who happen to be Aboriginal to live and thrive and form community according to their own values and their own needs. So I think the role of government in that case is to act as an enabler and a supporter of the mechanisms that make this possible. So, for example, minimally giving or making possible for people the capacity to communicate with each other, creating a legislative environment in which it's possible to live according to your own values and to share those values, things like that. So, like, you know, the old picture is take a piece of Aboriginal culture, put it in a movie or something and share it with everybody. And that, to me, is absurd. And it creates a caricature of the culture. The only way a culture survives is if people live it. And we have to create the conditions that allow people to live their own cultures individually in diversity, as opposed to creating this global monoculture through mass communication, mass education, and imposition of power.
Pressure for conformism, because I'm imagine to have a global representation of learning patterns can influence the individual behavior. So there's a strong pressure for conformism.
Absolutely.
Well, that's why I very much like your project here that preserves the European culture, the European languages. It's hard work. I've worked on European projects for all these different cultures to work together, but at the moment, there is a big Americanization of the world, and well, we have to do something to preserve your own culture, language.
Hoping for the sort of collapse of institutions generally. I'm going to point people towards the university because I understand what you're saying in terms of the collapse of credentialing and I think the Occupy movement was a very interesting example of that. That said, if I got to pick one or the other, I mean, maybe that's sort of just capitulation, but I mean, to me, it's also kind of like practical advice. You follow that advice, right?
Well, I mean, like, when somebody asks me, you know, should I go to university, I say, yes, absolutely. You know, try not to bankrupt yourself in the process.
I agree with that 100%.
You know, really, but yeah, absolutely, because right now in society there is no opportunity equal to that. And that includes online learning, because online learning is place-informed content. It's useless. You need to develop the social connections, the ability to try out different personas and different characters, the whole range of things, even simple things. Like in my talk, I talked about, you know how you recognize you're a physicist by the way you talk, by the way you think things are important. That's what you learn at a university that you don't learn in one of these typical MOOCs, right? That's what you learn in a university that you don't learn anywhere else. And people who have it can really easily spot it. People who don't have it, it's invisible. It seriously is invisible, and it does form these cultural barriers. But having it is better. It's better for your life. It's better for your career prospects, and even, you know, you'll have a more interesting life, more varied perspective. So yeah, go to university. But you know, that's today, right? My objective, one of my objectives, is to make that available for everyone. Right? Forget the content. The content's already available to everyone. We've won that. We really have. All right. Oh yeah, there are still some holdouts, but we've won. We have the internet. We have open content. We have all the stuff, and we have the capacity to create and share. It's beautiful. I love it. Now we have to go after the elites and enable everybody else to have that same capacity to form networks and communities, to express themselves, to have power. That does not exist now. So yes, go to university. But understand, if you're in the university system and that is your stock and trade, understand that that also is going to be put online.
Well, I think this was incredibly attractive, and I'm all the more happy that it's moving so much towards my ever to say original territory, but at the same time, I don't want this to become, a political sense conference meeting, because definitely the step forward would be incredibly interesting. And we all know this process of, obviously, wiring the elite has been an important object of a few guys, in Russia, and it had some interesting consequences. Some of them very, profitable, some a little less. But I love the way it's been shaped, and we, at this point, we only have to choose whether we. I think we may go on because the coffee break is going to be at left, so we still have time for.
Right.
At least part of the next round presentations, and then they stop, get coffee, and then come back.